horrific. One of the things I did, because this is the sort of thing I do after reading this Stern report, is I noticed that in there, buried in the Stern report, was a calculation of the damage done by each ton of carbon dioxide, each ton of carbon dioxide equivalent that is put up in the atmosphere, whether by us as individuals or by companies or by governments indeed. And Stern assessed that each ton of carbon emitted into the atmosphere does $85 worth of damage, which is a much higher estimate than had been calculated before by government economists. As we know, commodity markets, markets for goods and services, supermarkets, and indeed financial markets, do not tell the ecological truth at the moment. They do not incorporate these so-called externalities. So if you actually look at you look at this $85 and you do a quick back of the envelope calculation and take one of the Britain's largest listed companies, BP, that cost would be about, from its own emissions, the emissions from its refineries and so on, and if you priced that, those emissions at $85, that would be about 38% of annual profits. So that's quite a big, amount. The second, obviously, is BP is a producer of fossil fuels, oil and gas, which themselves have emissions, and companies estimated that its products have emissions of about 570 million. Again, if you price that, you get to a rather huge sum of the cost of the environmental cost of BP's products of $48 billion, which is over two times the company's annual replacement cost profit. And then if we go one step further and we look at actually how BP is going to be generating profits and earnings for its shareholders, the pensioners, charities, religious bodies, and individuals going forward, that is going to be from the value of the reserves it has in the ground, which will be extracted, refined, and put on the market. Now, traditionally, before we had the thought about climate change, those would have been thought of as assets. But now, perhaps in light of Stern, we need to think that these have attached to them an $85 per ton of carbon released liability. So as I said before, at the moment, normal markets, whether we go to the supermarkets, commodity markets, or financial markets, are not telling us the financial truth, the ecological truth about climate change. Is that an issue? Is that an issue particularly for us in London? I think it is. Some research we did last year, looking at the carbon, looking at the FTSE 100, found, I think, an interesting figure, that Britain is responsible as a nation for about 2% of global greenhouse gas emissions. But if you look at the emissions from particularly the fossil fuel companies that are listed on the London stock market, the BPs, the Shells, the Rio Tintos, and so on, their process and product emissions amount to between 10 and perhaps as high as 15% of global emissions. So if we are going into a low carbon economy, as the analysts suggest we should, and the government suggests we should, the London market appears to be particularly carbon intensive, and maybe we should be quite concerned about that. So what are the things that maybe people in the city, us as investors, should be doing, the things that we should be concerned about? First, obviously, is risk, the risk to our investments posed both by the process of internalizing these costs, and my assumption is that in democratic countries, eventually externalities get incorporated into price. So there's risk around that. But also there's obviously the direct risks of impacts of climate change. And as we know, unfortunately, whatever we do now, climate impacts for the next few decades are pretty much guaranteed. So there's a financial risk. I think there's another interesting risk, which is a social risk, and I think we'll see more of this. As the regulatory gap is seen to be bigger and bigger, I think we're going to have more protests like we saw this summer at Drax, more protests like we saw this month at Didcot Power Station. So there's a social risk as well. Clearly, the flip side of risk is opportunity, and as we all know, there are clean tech, low carbon funds being launched every week, and clearly there are huge opportunities being made for reallocating capital away from carbon intensive towards low carbon technologies and opportunities. But there are two other areas I think are also important for the financial community. Firstly is our accountability. One of the reactions to the earlier Enron corporate governance failures was a recognition that investors themselves had a part to play in improving corporate governance, particularly through publishing their voting records. And I think that going forward, one of the ways in which the city can be accountable is publishing, in a sense, their carbon records, the carbon footprints of their funds, which I think would be, if we're looking back in a few years, would be a very, very normal thing to do if we're living in a world whereby climate change is the most important issue we're facing. So accountability is another area I think we need to improve considerably. And finally, there is the issue of responsibility. Responsibility in terms of where I am as a fund manager on behalf of our investors, and responsibility ultimately as owners of companies. First, to engage with those companies and to encourage good practice there. But I think also to encourage the regulation that is going to internalize those costs. I think one of the interesting principles, for example, in the Hermes corporate governance principles is a principle that one of the things they should be engaging on is to close that gap between the $85, which we know is the damage that's been caused, and the market price, which at the moment is pricing carbon at pretty much zero. So I think there's an area of responsibility as owners to engage with companies to encourage good practice, but also to engage with policymakers to put in place the regulations that help drive us to a low carbon economy, both in terms of controlling emissions, and also I think perhaps thinking about what would financial regulation look like to make it fit for purpose for a low carbon economy. How would we need to think again about financial regulation so it's really encouraging the allocation of capital towards low carbon options and away from carbon intensive options? Thank you.
Before I introduce our second speaker, I should have just said at the beginning, the format of this is after our two speakers have given their introductory remarks, then we open up for questions from the floor. So do start to formulate questions and we'll try and have a general discussion. And we will finish promptly at 2:05, because I know many of you have to get straight off to work. But now it's a great pleasure to introduce John Reynolds. John comes here wearing two hats today. He comes as both the chief executive of Nikko Energy, but also as chairman of the Church of England's Ethical Investment Advisory Group. John.
Ed, thank you. Companies and their shareholders are quite simply unable to act in isolation of global competitors and government-set economic incentives. We can't afford to get carried away, even with Kyoto, as a means to an international solution. Under Article 3 of the Protocol, reductions of greenhouse gases are benchmarked against a 1990 base date. There's been a lot of global change since 1990. India and China have seen tremendous economic growth, and the level of energy production in the former Soviet Union has collapsed. According to US government estimates, the 2003 total carbon dioxide emissions from the FSU were 35% below the 1990 levels. If Kyoto is implemented on a global basis, what will happen is wealth transfer from the US primarily and secondarily the EU to the former Soviet Union, with no or little resulting reduction in carbon emission. And Kyoto is, after all, only binding until 2012. The problem for governments is one identified by Tony Blair at the time of the publication of the Stern Report: how to build an international consensus. Without international consensus, in the absence of very clear incentives, industries and companies will not be able to radically change their behavior. National initiatives cannot be pushed far without affecting international competitiveness, threatening jobs, and therefore becoming vote-losing policies. Given the failure of major trade and environmental initiatives, the current background isn't inspiring when it comes to reaching international consensus. The Doga trade round collapsed after 5 years of talks, and the first phase of the EU emissions trading scheme has descended into farce, with no clarity available on the EU ETS beyond the end of the still unfinalised phase two due to start next year. We need to use caution in understanding the benefit of emissions trading. Wealth transfer between companies or states does not reduce emissions on its own. And certainly, I'm aware of little evidence that domestic consumption of energy is reduced significantly by price increases. Ethical decision making, including regarding the environment, within most companies is a prerogative of the board and is not pushed down within the company. There is often a tendency within those boards that take ethical issues seriously for dangerously utilitarian arguments to be brought forward regarding investments, which runs something like this. We would be a better steward for those assets. We would run those assets with less emissions, less pollution, and therefore it is better for us to buy it. This is a great argument because it can justify anything. It implies no limit to activities, provided there is someone worse. In general, there is a tendency among the majority of companies for governance and SRI issues to become a legalistic and tick-box exercise. Quite frequently, these areas are the prerogative of a company secretary, where other real investment-related decisions are the prerogative of a finance director or divisional managing director. Environmental issues will not be an intrinsic part of decision-making processes, investment processes, while they remain part of a legal function instead of being embedded in individual businesses. Divisional managers frequently have limited exposure to big issues, as opposed to being judged against immediate targets to either be, and are therefore not fully aware of or inspired to factor carbon-related issues into their decisions. Investment managers, both of quoted and unquoted investments, will also, other than the small minority of SRI funds, remain very much focused on financial performance of investments above all else. Increasing transparency is excellent and helps inform investment decisions, but who disinvested in Scottish and Southern Energy when they dramatically changed their environmental position by buying two major coal-fired power stations, which turned out to be an excellent investment decision? Their carbon emissions have increased from about 8.5 million tonnes to around 25 million tonnes. Anglo-American states in this year's Sustainable Development Report that, and I'll quote this, our focus has been on making sustainable development an intuitive but conscious part of every decision. Mark Moody Stewart, the chairman of Anglo, is spot on here. Thinking about sustainable development needs to be inculcated in corporate decision making. Separating out the good and the bad is not always simple or meaningful. We need to look at the good and the bad in corporate behaviour, including in the environment, as Nick has said. But we need to be very careful how this is interpreted. Starting with the bad, Nick's report highlighted five companies in the FTSE 100 responsible for two-thirds of FTSE 100 greenhouse emissions. One of these was Scottish Power. Since Scottish Power's sale of its US subsidiary Pacificorp last year, its emissions have decreased dramatically, from 63 million tonnes to, for the last calendar year, about 15 million tonnes. That's 63 down to 15. It is, at the same time, the UK's largest developer of wind farms. This is an interesting example of a company which may have moved from the bad to a good category in the space of a year. Bear in mind, though, that the US subsidiary Pacificorp is now owned by another utility, MidAmerican. It continues to mine the same amount of coal. It continues to burn the same amount of coal in its power stations. Scottish Power has made a dramatic reduction in carbon emissions. Hey, fantastic, aren't they great? But this has made no difference to the world. So, if we need to be careful about the bad and the good, what are the good doing? Good initiatives tend to be well-trailed as the companies that implement them like some publicity. HSBC, as is well known, has gone carbon neutral through three things: reducing energy use, buying green electricity, and, more contentious, offsetting. However, for a bank, the costs and implications of this policy are much less onerous than for an energy company or a raw materials company. I calculate that the cost is equivalent to £14.40 per HSBC employee in the first year. That is all. We need to use caution interpreting emissions data, caution interpreting company decision making, and understand that company decision making does not and cannot on its own reflect environmental concerns. There are simply much higher financial priorities. And the major issue here is the availability of the classic economist conundrum, the free ride. Few companies will be able to make a costly, positive stand if their competitors can be rewarded for going the other way, making short-term high returns from opportunistic investment in environmentally damaging activities. And let's face it, with the trend towards private ownership of large businesses, transparency is decreasing in many sectors. If clear and effective government policies are not in place, the environmentally responsibly managed companies will, at least in the short term, see a relative decline. Their less conscientious competitors will thrive, and this goes for competition between countries as well as competition between companies. And competition between countries cannot be underestimated on the global stage. So there are two models possible to change behavior: self-regulation and policy change. Self-regulation will not work on its own. In an ideal world, the challenge for major companies is to inculcate conscious awareness of carbon in all investment decision making. Divisional managers, who are making most day-to-day decisions, need to be assessed and incentivized not just on short-term financial impacts. Boards should not be the major bastions of ethical considerations. And when they are, they should distrust these dangerous utilitarian arguments I referred to earlier. Large companies are more global in operation and outlook than governments can be, and are incentivized to have regard to suppliers and customers in a mix of countries. As the examples I've used earlier show, many large companies in those industries which intrinsically create most emissions are trying to reduce their emissions. For some, but only a minority, it will be sufficient to highlight that environmental regulation will probably tighten, and therefore a slightly higher cost now will offset risk in future. For others, this will not be enough to stimulate a change. Corporate managers and investment managers will not be able to take a longer-term view if environmental issues are not costed into decisions as a result of government policy internationally. Global players with very long-term operations and reputational value to protect need to protect against the risk of adverse regulatory change. Smaller players, privately funded new entrants, can take substantially greater risks. This, as I said, is a free ride, and it's exacerbated by, in the absence of international consensus and government policy, a need for self-regulation. And a vague form of self-regulation, a collection of self-denying ordinances for companies' investors, will not work sufficiently well to drive a big impact on a global scale. Investors' fiduciary duties and those of trustees are so clear with money management that they will be driven by returns. Change requires a political framework. So going to the title of the debate, can the city reduce its carbon footprint? Direct reduction for service companies, city-type companies, is not unduly costly. HSBC calculated its commitment to becoming carbon neutral would cost up to £3.6 million in 2005. As I said, that's £14.40 per employee, roughly. However, for the city to see a reduction in the carbon footprint for all its areas of influence, companies where city institutions advise or are shareholders, is less simple. To see these changes among the major polluting industries requires policy change, popular pressure, and clear economic incentives. The city, as investors, the city as advisors, will share the culpability if immediate low-cost changes are not made, and we can all influence investee and client companies to adopt changes which do not undermine existing businesses ahead of policy changes. But to get the big changes, Governments need to set a policy framework. Tax change is central to this. Government needs to influence popular opinion. The city needs to influence corporate and popular opinion. And at the same time, government policy will be determined by popular opinion. Public education can work, but not if it's subtle. This is unsubtle public education. It works. A pack of cigarettes says smoking kills. Very simple. The Stern report does not work in tabloid headline terms. In the Sun, smoking kills does. That is how to make popular education work. If the political will is not there, populist movements can change the world. In 1645, the Battle of Naseby changed government forever. The deciding battle of the Civil War was won by the New Model Army, a bunch of, I expect, greasy-haired, uneducated people who'd come together from the basis of religion and religious fundamentalism, took on one of the mightiest royal armies in Europe and won, and had sufficient power to ensure that Parliament remained attentive to the demands of that popular army before that army then disbanded itself. Popular movements have changed the world. Popular movements can still change the world. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, both of you. We've got some very wide-ranging issues raised from the Battle of Naseby to the City of London. If anyone has a question, please raise your hand and Hannah will arrive, pounce on you with a roving mic. Thank you.
Yes, a question, well, a couple of statements and a question. I'm Roy Tindall. I work within London Diocese advising on energy issues. I'm also an advisor to Compass, a Labour think tank on energy, and a member of the Aldersgate Group. I listened to what you both say. I think first in terms of carbon trading, at the Aldersgate Group last week, we had people like Sir John Harman of the Environment Agency predicting a carbon price of between £5 and £0 within 10 years, because the levels have been set so high that they're not catching anyone. And carbon trading thus far has not produced any diminution in emissions whatsoever. But I think that there is a move afoot amongst some corporations here who realize that their future lies in doing something rather than doing nothing. And there's groups like Aldersgate where we are pressuring the government to take action because simply the government do not. I don't think it's a lack of political will. I think it's a lack of science. I don't think we have anyone in government who understands climate science or energy science at all. And so they err on the side of doing nothing. But what I would like to ask is, the greatest problem I see is that everyone involved, from the Prime Minister downwards, keeps saying that it's someone's job to do something. In terms of Tony Blair, it's Britain going to Nairobi and telling the rest of the world they ought to do something. In terms of the common populace, we had a march on the 4th of November with people, as usual, appearing outside the US Embassy, telling the US Embassy they ought to be doing something. Really, what it is about is changing the perception of all of us, and that perception has to take place in industry as well. I'm not going to go on, but in March I'll be taking a group of 50 Compass MPs on a walk through London looking at energy waste. Can I ask everyone here today, when they go out, to start looking at the lights that are not needed, the incandescents in their place of work that could be replaced? And this happens in organizations that support doing something about climate change. They still use incandescent lamps. So how do we change corporates at that level? Because it's not just the big change. It's the aggregation of incremental change that produces the effect. How do we induce that sea change in thought that it's not just about pushing government to take action, but it's about looking at all the small changes that we can add together where we work that will cut our energy bills. And finally, look at Walmart. Not exactly the best examples of corporate social responsibility. Walmart are not only saving energy and saving money, that's the bottom line to them, but they're going down in the States through their supply chains to get them to cut their energy too, so they can get lower prices.
Thank you. We have a chief executive here. I just wonder what the chief executive wants to say about changing corporate culture to start off with.
Well, thanks, Ed. Let me say something about that, and then let me pick up just one brief thing on the government side. I think you're picking up very well one of the points I made, that the biggest problem within a company is culture change. The biggest problem is inculcating a change of culture through ranks of middle managers who will, on average, have been within a company or an industry for 15 years plus. That's hard to do. That's why Anglo-American, who are in the extractive industries, obviously, are right to be doing this. And I think the pressure needs to come from outside. It needs to come from customers and shareholders, lobbying groups, churches, and it needs to come from inside the companies as well. And it needs everything heading in the same direction. From a political perspective, I mean, just think about the UK position. We have published and completed a consultation process, the DTI has completed it, on energy. The energy minister who carried that out was last week reshuffled to a different department. That's helpful. There is a white paper that will be published in March. Nothing is going to happen with the UK in isolation of the United States. The United States now has got a lame duck president in place for 2 years. So nothing's going to happen until the next presidential election in the States in terms of UK policy, because we'll be hamstrung by being out of step with the US. And then we're going to have to wait for the next general election here, because Gordon Brown won't want to make any vote-losing decisions on terms of the environment. And consequently, we are not going to get a significant development in UK government policy until 2010. So the only way that's going to change is through popular movement and popular pressure on the government and on the companies. But the companies themselves cannot afford to unilaterally increase their cost basis, or they will lose market share to competitors in other countries. And it's the popular pressure that is going to have to build up in order to bring about the real change. But I fundamentally agree with the points you're making, which are very well made. I always say that when people agree with me, but I think they're extremely good points.
Thank you. Nick, you're working in a sector which has emerged as part of a changing culture in the city in the last 15, 20 years or so. And do you have a perspective on this?
I agree with John that it's only people who ever change things. And I think we are going to see probably some quite substantial upsurge, and particularly direct action protest against, as we've seen already, on Drax and Didcot in the last 3 months. So I think there will be, because the government has not delivered in terms of reducing climate emissions, I think we will see an upsurge of that. I think what is faced with us is, in a sense, the downward spiral, as John has presented. There are very, very strong reasons and rationales, self-reinforcing reasons, why action is very, very difficult. The international competitiveness, the difficulty of agreeing, and so on and so forth. And that downward spiral has, I think, been in operation since the agreement of the Climate Convention in 1992, where George Bush Sr. very clearly said, our lifestyle is not up for negotiation. There was a huge missed opportunity for the richest nation in the world to actually show to the emerging economies that you can have low carbon prosperity. And that is why I think actually it is so important for action to be taken here, is to show to the Chinas, the Indias and Brazils and so on, that actually they can develop, but develop in a way that is very, very light in terms of carbon. So that is where I think we have a huge responsibility, not just to drive down our own emissions, but to give a model for affluence, as it were, to other markets. So in terms of the popular idea, I think one of the big challenges, say, for the environmental movement is the issue of personal carbon quotas. If you look at the industrial emission trading scheme, it started with a voluntary scheme and moved into a regulated scheme. I think the issue is, to what extent can the environmental movement deliver hundreds of thousands of households who are going to voluntarily commit to reducing their carbon and trading among themselves as a model which can then be adopted as a regulated model, and indeed then can be picked up worldwide. And that would show to the politicians that people actually do care about that and start creating that upward spiral, which I think the potential is there, but at the moment, as I think John very clearly explained, the reasons for inaction are very powerful, and then we get the Great Depression, the First World War, and the Second World War by the end of this century, which we all know is going to be a disaster, not least for the funds that our successors will be managing.
Thank you. The gentleman at the front had a question.
Thank you. I was just referring back to the gentleman's point about lights sort of on in the city. I was at a meeting at St. Paul's last week, which is about carbon footprint. And as I came to get the bus at the end of the evening, the place was, the whole of the city everywhere around me was lit up. I'm sure lots of people were working very, very late, but I'm sure there were also lots of people who weren't, that the offices were, the lights were just on. I read an article last week about the fact that ice sheets are melting and receding. I think in Alaska, oil companies are rushing in seemingly to try and exploit the oil that is possibly there, which is going to add to the amount of carbon in the atmosphere, which is going to make the ice go back, more oil companies are going to go in and want to drill. In the light of that, plus the fact that in the next few years we're going to be asked to go from analog to digital television, which I think I'm right, draws more energy than an analog television. I am trying desperately as a person to, I've got my lights, my special low energy light bulbs, I turn off the standby buttons, I'm doing all of this. I'm becoming bewildered by information out there at the moment. I'm getting to the point where I really don't know what else I can do. I hear about hybrid cars that are the next thing. I then hear that actually the hybrid car isn't the best sort of car to have because of its longevity and all sorts of different things. I need as much information as I can get, and I don't know where to go.
Let's try an energy expert sitting up there, standing up there.
That's a very long, meandering question, so I do apologise.
I think you're hitting on an excellent point. I think the information out there for people to understand how to run their own lives in a way that makes the minimum damage to the world doesn't exist. I think it's virtually impossible to understand, are you better putting a wind turbine up on your roof, or does that cause more damage because of the necessary grid reinforcement and surplus capacity that needs to be on the system? And at the moment, it depends on precisely where you are in the country and what control systems you have. I absolutely agree with the point about digital TV. Digital TV uses 10 times as much electricity as analog. And you know, particularly if it's left on and standby, and I think digital TV is a massive issue. And I think there is a lot more that can be done. And I think one of the problems we've got here is, you know, in the end, information could come out of the broader electricity industry, but let's face it, trade associations, when they say things, tend not to be very helpful. In terms of government policy, government guidance, you've got to get some joined up thinking between the DTI, the Treasury, and DEFRA. And again, that doesn't happen very well. So we've got some rather silly reasons why there isn't better public guidance as to what to do. And a lot of the information out there, I agree with you, I think is actively misleading in terms of how to reduce your own carbon footprint. And that is something where there is a vacuum of good quality information.
Nick, are you bewildered?
I think actually that there's not a lack of information. Actually, there's probably too much information. Probably what we don't have is ways of changing our habits. So actually, probably many of us have read the green lifestyle supplements in magazines and read all these things. But the question is, how does that affect the habits that we have? So I think one of the challenges is for community groups and others is to change the culture and actually start doing things with our neighbours, in our sports clubs, in our churches, and whatever, and actually start comparing and contrasting. I don't think it's information, it's actually cultural change, behavioural change, which actually, for individuals, is you do it what you do with other people. I think trying as individuals to do it on our own is a recipe for disaster. We need to do it with others. And similarly, for the city, I think it is a question of very big behavioural change about how we do become mindful of carbon. Much of that is going to need to come from regulation, as I said, to put carbon on the balance sheet, so actually when people do evaluate the big emitters and indeed the banks that lend to them and and so on, that carbon now has to leap off the page, which it doesn't at the moment. But also a behavioural change there is actually how do we get the investment bankers, the fund managers and pension fund trustees to fully think about climate change in terms of the way that these assets are being managed. We're not there yet. The awareness is there that this is very serious, but the behaviours haven't yet changed.
Thank you. Yes, gentleman at the back.
Hi, I work in idealistic media, and I think it's one thing you haven't mentioned yet. You've talked about business, you've talked about governments, and I think the media is the third big influencer. It wins you elections and it wins you a popular cultural lifestyle. And I think you had a good point when you're showing the cigarette packet, and that shows people straight away how they should act. You see the cigarette packet, if I smoke this, I'm going to get cancer, perhaps I'm going to die 20 years before I should do. With communicating sustainable development, things like this, it's how do you do that? Because if you're talking about changing light bulbs, but there's not change your light bulb now, otherwise, you know, you're going to roast or you're going to die. It's, you know, maybe your children's children are going to have problems. So how can you get, it's about procrastination, basically, which is the whole problem with why we're not acting. We are acting, but we're acting way too slow for what we have to do. So how can we communicate this sense of urgency through, I think, the other thing that we didn't really talk about, which is media, which has a lot of power to influence both in business and then popular culture.
John, do you want to respond to that? You had the cigarette packet.
Yeah, absolutely. And anyone who wants cigarettes afterwards, welcome to them. I don't smoke. I think there are two things. And you're right to pick up the influence that the media can have here. The first thing is just the reality. Global warming will kill hundreds of millions of people. Through drought, mudslides, flood, natural disaster, it will kill hundreds of millions of people. And the messages can be given very clearly and very succinctly. And that is the type of communication that, in particular, given the media in this country we have, where we are probably more tabloid than other developed countries, we need to have tabloid-type messages. The second thing is, as a result of that, we can make it personally unacceptable, or rather socially unacceptable, not to respond to the challenge of climate change. It's like drink driving. Drink driving kills. Remember the adverts on drink driving, remember the adverts regarding condoms on AIDS. When a popular education campaign is orchestrated on that basis, it works. The whole culture of tobacco smoking was something that might kill you 30 years out, and tobacco smoking is now a minority pastime in this country, unlike some others, and it will reduce further with further changes in legislation. So I think the short answer to your question is, government needs to be very clear about the messages in terms of what the impact is, which they understand now. But it's an interesting one. Tony Blair and Gordon Brown can communicate on a very effective popular level on some issues, but don't on this. That's interesting. And the second thing is, it can be made, I think, socially unacceptable. And I think it's a social unacceptability because you are killing hundreds of millions of people. Now, for those who are not going to respond to the, oh, well, it's killing hundreds of millions of people, I don't mind, because they're in Africa, who are of that type, there is a simple answer, is that where's the rest of the people from Africa going to come? They're going to come north to Western Europe. Massive population displacement. Even those who will not take a Christian or ethical, charitable view, will still take the impact of hundreds of millions of refugees coming into Europe as being a very good reason for change.
Just thinking about John's image of the cigarette packet, I think it's a very powerful one. In a sense, it is that products need to have cars, airplane flights, whatever. That little sticker saying carbon kills. We know from the WHO that 150,000 people already worldwide are dying as a result of climate-induced disasters. One of the reasons, however, that we know why information is not sufficient, if we look at the tobacco issue, that has been well known to be a health hazard. We've had the labeling for many years. The reason why it is where we still have the stubborn 20-25% of the population still smokes is because they're addicted. And maybe we can think of that metaphor for what we are. We are actually addicted to highly carbon-intensive lifestyles. Do we not need to have, as they had at the party political broad conferences this year, climate clinics, or indeed a new organization called Carbon Anonymous, where the first sentence you ever utter is, "I am a carbon criminal." And from there on, you are cured of your criminality. But I think it is that direction. Information is not going to be enough because, in many senses, culturally, not biologically, we are addicted to carbon-intensive activities.
So you're going to go around with stickers on Chelsea tractors, "You're a carbon criminal." You think this would be it could be a thing to do. The gentleman right at the back wants to ask a question.
I think one of the main, in my opinion, one of the main behavioural changes needed is we've got to convince consumers that price is not the only factor to take into account when you're buying something. And I'm as guilty of this as everybody else. When you buy something at a certain price, inevitably somebody tells you they bought the same thing cheaper the week before, or you could have got it cheaper if you'd gone to somewhere else. I do it, I think we all do it. Somehow we've got to change that attitude. I think the most effective campaign recently, or in the last 20 years, was the change to wearing seatbelts, which was a combination of advertising and penalty. And I think now 99% of drivers do wear a seatbelt. I'm not convinced that a slogan on cigarette packets does much than reduce it. I don't think it'll ever eliminate smoking. So I think it has got to be a combination of publicity plus penalty.
I think there's an issue about how one deals with externalities, and one approach is to try to make people aware of externalities, but the other is to internalise them into the market, which is very much what the Stern report was saying. And I wonder whether you'd like to just comment on how one goes about that economic transformation of bringing external costs and internalise them, and how realistic and easy will that transition be. Perhaps we would start with Nick on that question.
Well, just picking up what John was saying earlier about the emissions trading program process so far, it has been deeply flawed. It has, in a sense, been a subsidy program at the moment. The permits, the allowances are not auctioned as they should be, and as we know, the caps have been far too high. So as you were saying earlier, the emissions haven't been driven down. I think carbon pricing is one way, and carbon trade is one way, but I think we shouldn't perhaps forget, particularly maybe when we're talking about individual action, other actions which are around regulation, particularly in this country, for example, about why can't we over time ensure that all the housing stock in Britain, not just the new housing stock, is climate proofed. A lot of the housing here is on mortgages. Any cost can be run over a 25-year period. And I think that would be, rather than, in a sense, introducing a pricing system for individuals, which could actually be quite socially regressive, actually have a standards-based system. So we need to have pricing. I think pricing works very well for the city. So as I said, we need to think about how we need to make accounting and company disclosures fit for purpose for a low-carbon economy, which they're clearly not at the moment. But pricing is not the only mechanism. And I do fear that actually, in a sense, the emissions trading scheme could come in for disrepute if actually it was popularly known the size of the windfalls that many of the big energy utilities were winning at the moment because of this scheme.
Thank you. John.
Okay. I just want to give some perspective on this. The biggest causes of greenhouse gases are cars, aeroplanes, and use of electricity. Aeroplanes, it is easy to propose a mechanism to bring air transport into the emission trading scheme, which will come in Europe within either phase two or phase three of the ETS. That will spell the end of popular low-cost air travel and will be a massive vote loser, which is why it can be implemented on an EU basis, because no one elects the EU. It's a fascinating thing that they actually have more power to push things through than national governments in some ways. But will be a very big issue. And I think air travel has got to be gripped given the scale of emissions associated. And the cost, the carbon cost associated with this, if it's properly priced, will kill off the low-cost airlines. And it's interesting, but it has to happen. Cars, again, the level of emissions has improved dramatically, but can go a lot further. In the end, the only clean form of energy production we have in terms of greenhouse emissions is nuclear power. And if we move to electric vehicles, which there is a move to do in California, not successfully yet, but electric vehicles fueled from nuclear power would wipe out a huge amount of greenhouse gases, give one or two other problems along the way, but you know, push it under the carpet for the next 100,000 years. But it does solve the greenhouse problems. In terms of your specific question, sir, what you're asking about, I think really comes down to a combination of what is appropriate to apply as a cost. So not every product can be costed in terms of its environmental damage, but at which case there also needs to be standards. I mean, you mentioned seatbelts. At one stage, there was no standard that said seatbelts had to be in cars, then there had to be some front seatbelts, then there had maybe some lap belts, then inertia belts, and the standards have got tighter and tighter and tighter. And I think this is the same with carbon. Where carbon affects things, we should have tighter standards. But the single biggest thing we need to do, going back to priority, is to ban burning coal. Coal is a dirty fuel that cannot effectively be cleaned up. Why are we incentivizing industry to burn more and more coal at the moment? It's absolute madness given the long-term cost.
We could go on to a long debate on carbon sequestration, nuclear power and everything, but I'm afraid we're running out of time. And there's just enough time just to ask our speakers if there's one final comment they would like to make, to send home message.
Yep. I think the one thing is maybe people, all the people in this room, one way or another, will have investments. And I think the simple thing in our pensions, whatever, is to actually challenge the managers of those investors, or if you're in a pension scheme, the trustees, to make clear to you what the carbon footprint of your investments are, and what the manager is doing to make that footprint smaller.
Bring back the new model army.
Thank you. On that note, just to say that those of you don't have to dash off, I think there are some refreshments at the back, and I'm sure our speakers will be around for a few minutes. If there are any burning questions you didn't get a chance to ask, thank you very much indeed for coming, and shall we thank our speakers in the accustomed manner.